This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, COVID mystery. The search continues for the source of New Zealand's coronavirus outbreak. The Australian trials to test whether man's best friend can sniff out COVID-19.
The dogs could be a real game changer. Even picking up 10 asymptomatic people in a week's time, that can lead to 100 or more cases. So to flatten the curve and try and suppress, the dogs are going to be vital.
It was an historic event held in pretty much an empty room with no applause. The US presidential hopeful Joe Biden's appeared with his new running mate for the first time since placing Kamala Harris on the Democratic ticket. It was a launch unlike previous campaigns, with strict social distancing guidelines ruling out the enthusiastic crowds of supporters who've been a hallmark of past elections. Our North America correspondent is David Lipson. David, for months Joe Biden's been talking about the importance of chemistry and trust with his running mate. Was that on display today?
Sabra, good morning. In a word, no, it wasn't really on display. Not to say that it wasn't there, it just wasn't really visible because of the social distancing restrictions. They were not only just, 1.5 metres away from each other on stage, but closer to 3 or 4 metres away from each other. So pretty unusual, but still a lot of warm words from Joe Biden. First of all, towards Kamala Harris, he pointed out that she was the child of immigrants, that her story is America's story, and said that little black and brown girls around America just maybe are seeing themselves in a new way today. Let's hear some of what Joe Biden had to say.
Kamala, as you all know, is smart. She's tough. She's experienced. She's a proven fighter for the backbone of this country, the middle class, for all those who are struggling to get into the middle class. Kamala knows how to govern. She knows how to make the hard calls. She's ready to do this job on day one.
That's US Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. David, if the Democrats win the election, Kamala Harris will be the first female vice president. What she had to say today about the position she now finds herself in?
Well, she is clearly proud and happy and honoured to be in the position that she's in. But really, a lot of her speech today, which was a pretty impressive speech, you'd have to say, was focused on coronavirus and an attack as well on the current administration, the Trump administration. She said that the case against Donald Trump was open and shut, pointing out his failure to take COVID-19 seriously from the start. And she also said that the Democrats needed more than a victory in November, that they needed a mandate for all Americans to put the last 4 years behind them. Here's some of what Kamala Harris had to say.
America is crying out for leadership. Yet we have a president who cares more about himself than the people who elected him. A president who is making every challenge we face even more difficult to solve. But here's the good news. We don't have to accept the failed government of Donald Trump and Mike Pence. In just 83 days, we have a chance to choose a better future for our country.
That's the US Democratic vice presidential nominee, Kamala Harris. What's been the broader reaction in the US to the choice of Kamala Harris as the Democratic vice presidential pick?
Well, among Democrats, there's a lot of enthusiasm about Kamala Harris. Of course, there are some on the far left who don't like the fact that she was a prosecutor, a pretty firm prosecutor in California and attorney general as well. There has been a cry that has been going out amongst those far left members of the Democrat Party or the political spectrum spectrum that Kamala Harris is a cop. And that is, to many of the people who've been marching on the streets, not a good thing. But for the vast majority of Democrats, it's been a big sigh of relief, I think, because she's seen as a very safe pair of hands. She's been proven on the electoral stage, even though she didn't get the nomination, in fact, dropped out quite early in the piece. She will be seen by many as a very good partner for Joe Biden. The Trump administration has, as expected, gone hard on the attack. The attack ads came out within minutes of the announcement yesterday, and they've continued through the day. We're waiting to hear from Donald Trump today, but yesterday he described Kamala Harris as nasty, using very firm language against her, the type of language you'd have to say that isn't normally directed at men. So we can expect a lot more of that in the days to come.
That's our North America correspondent, David Lipson. An Auckland high school student has tested positive for COVID-19. They're the latest person to have acquired the virus in a resurgence of community transmission in New Zealand. The student was a close contact to four family members who are at the centre of this outbreak. Authorities are scrambling to identify the mystery source of the infection, with the clock ticking down on an initial lockdown period of 3 days. Barbara Miller reports.
Life has taken a depressingly familiar turn for Aucklanders. Checkpoints, pop-up clinics, closed businesses, and the anxious wait for news of any new cases. The latest is a student at the city's Mount Albert Grammar, the country's second largest school with 3,000 students. Dr. Ashley Bloomfield is the Director General of Health.
The communication went out to the Mount Albert Grammar School community last night, and that is off the back of a student testing positive. This was a student who was followed up as a close contact related to the existing four positive cases we have had.
The student is the first officially confirmed case outside four members of one household in South Auckland who are at the centre of the new outbreak. A level 3 lockdown is in place in the city until at least midnight tomorrow, as authorities race to try and find the source. Among the possibilities under investigation is that the virus has been in the community for some weeks undetected, and whether or not there's a super spreader. Professor Sean Hendy is an infectious diseases modeller from the University of Auckland.
The family, they don't have a direct connection to the border, and so of course one possible route of transmission is from a returning traveller who's passed that on to someone working in a border facility, who's then passed that on to someone else, who's then passed that on to this family. And if that's the case, we could be looking at, you know, 3 to 4 weeks since the first introduction. Yeah, we're certainly considering that possibility at the moment.
If that is the case, what does it tell us about the number of positives you're likely to find?
Yeah, it's telling us that we might be seeing anywhere from a couple of dozen active cases out there at the moment through to 5 or 6 times that. I guess the concern is that there may have been a super spreading event somewhere back in the chain. We had 5 or 6 of these big events, so back in March in our first outbreak. There was a wedding, there was a St. Patrick's Day celebration. So those kind of events are possible, indeed quite common with COVID-19.
Now, there's also this other theory that perhaps a cool store where one of the infected people works could be the source of infection, in that he's touched freight that's come in from overseas. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, so there does seem to be some international evidence that we've had transmission that way. It's an unlikely route for transmission. On the other hand, you know, that would be good news if that was the route of transmission in, because that means we'd have it's a direct transmission to the worker and the family, and so we'd be looking at a much smaller outbreak.
The re-emergence of community transmission is a wake-up call for a country which had been basking in its COVID-free status. Professor Paparangi Reid is a co-leader of the Māori pandemic group Te Rōpō Whakakōpapa Urita.
I do think that we came out of our lockdown with great sense of relief and with a little bit of a sense of it won't happen again, and a little bit of a sense of skiting to the rest of the world that we were rather bulletproof.
The authorities will be giving an update on any more positive cases after yesterday's testing blitz in a media conference later today.
Barbara Miller reporting there. It's never a good feeling to see an F on your final marks for class, but some students failing courses could soon have much more dire consequences than that. A new proposal from the federal government would see uni students who fail more than half of their subjects in the first year lose their access to government financial support. Student representatives are already labelling it punitive, but one expert thinks it could help address disengagement within the system. Gavin Coote reports.
The federal government says it's taking this action because it's worried about students racking up massive debts while at the same time failing their subjects. Education Minister Dan Tehan says he's seen cases where students have been enrolled in multiple universities, notching up HECS or help debts of $220,000 to $660,000, while on average passing just one in five subjects they've attempted.
What this is designed to do is to make sure that universities and students understand that they need to work together to make sure that the student is suitable for the course that they're undertaking, and then to make sure that throughout their course that they get the guidance, support and help that they need to complete their studies. What we don't want to see is students taking on a study load they can't complete, leaving them without a qualification and a large debt.
Andrew Norton is a professor of higher education policy at Australian National University.
Many students, in my view, fail unintentionally. That is that they have enrolled, effectively dropped out, but they haven't done the paperwork and ensured they've formally withdrawn. And as a result, they end up with fails on their record and help debt they should never have incurred.
Under the changes being proposed, students who fail more than 50% of eight or more units in a bachelor course will no longer be able to access Commonwealth subsidies. Andrew Norton can see some pros and cons with the plan.
I've got some real concerns about how they're trying to implement it, which is probably overly bureaucratic. But I think in general terms, we do need to do more to manage disengaged and failing students. And so some version of what has been proposed is definitely worth considering.
What kind of signal do you think this will send to university students? Will it be an incentive for them to boost their performance or maybe avoid university altogether?
I think mostly to boost performance. They will have that added layer of anxiety that if I don't pass, then I will lose my funding. And that may encourage things such as usually there is a date to withdraw your enrolment without fail, going onto your academic record. And I'm sure there'll be a lot more focus on that date if people realise that potentially their funding is at risk.
But President of the National Union of Students, Molly Wilmot, doesn't buy that.
This isn't the government putting students' best interests at heart. This is the government trying to rehaul education into a corporatised, less student-centric structure that punishes students for studying.
If students can show their academic performance has been affected by illness or bereavement, their debts will be forgiven and it won't affect their ability to apply for future courses. But Molly Wilmot says that doesn't go far enough.
We're looking at a crisis of mental health in students right now where they're not reporting to their university that they're depressed or they have anxiety. And those are the things that really punish students. It's students with disabilities who can't access proper support at their universities. It's students who face discrimination on their campuses who don't feel like they can go to class who are really going to get hurt from this package.
Do you think it will incentivise better performance for some students, though?
I don't think that incentivising through fear brings the best results or puts students in a more job-ready mindset. It will just put more pressure on students in degrees, which will, lead to just to further issues with mental health that we're already suffering with, especially this year.
That's Molly Wilmot, and she's the president of the National Union of Students, and she was talking with our reporter, Gavin Coote. You're listening to AM. Thanks for your company, and it's 13 past 8. Multicultural communities say some of the official translations of the public health messages about COVID-19 are nonsensical and laughable. The errors being made in both federal and Victorian government campaigns, prompting concerns that migrants and refugees could lose confidence in how officials are handling the pandemic or even ignore them altogether. Here's political reporter Stephanie Dalzell.
Each day, Australia's most senior health officials are giving us updates about the pandemic, and some of that crucial advice is being dubbed into multiple languages. Trouble is, some of the translations are so flawed, they're incomprehensible.
The writing on the publication or the pamphlet itself, it's almost like it's gibberish. And it's actually nonsensical. So anyone that reads Arabic or knows how to read Arabic, when they do read that publication, it makes no sense whatsoever.
That's Dina Yarko from the Refugee Council of Australia. A native Arabic speaker, she's noticed mistakes in a federal government online campaign encouraging people to wear masks.
It is almost laughable when you look at these translations and these publications that have been used by the federal government or even our state governments. Obviously, communities have a lot of trust in their government. And when you do come across these publications that are incorrect, inaccurate, and have actually the wrong information on them, it becomes questionable. And of course, the community will then lose that trust.
A spokesperson for the Federal Department of Health says the error in the Arabic translation was rectified quickly. And the mistake had happened when the document was uploaded onto the website. The department says it intends to have translators check the websites from now on. But that hasn't been the only mistake. Another image tweeted by the federal government is supposed to tell Chinese speakers where to look for more details about the pandemic, but instead, the translation doesn't make any sense. And a Victorian government campaign features information in both Farsi and Arabic, two entirely different languages with a similar alphabet. Carla Wilshire is the CEO of the Migration Council Australia.
In the rush to get a lot of information out to migrant communities, it has been a little bit hit and miss. Some of the translations have been of a particularly formal nature or have grammar mistakes or syntax errors.
To fix that, she's suggesting vital messages are double or even triple checked by accredited translators. And she says governments have to work more closely with community leaders to ensure messages actually get through.
Most of us don't necessarily check a government website regularly as a source of information. So part of the process of getting information out is not just translating it, but also making sure that those translations are then being pushed out properly to communities.
A spokesperson for the Victorian Department of Health says its campaign to reach multicultural communities extends across TV, radio, print, digital and social, as well as using community leaders to deliver messages.
Stephanie Dalzell with that report. Along with problems translating key public health information, there are concerns lockdown restrictions are leaving refugees living in regional towns isolated and unable to access essential care. Many community centres have been closed for months, reducing the availability of mental health support for new migrants who can't afford other forms of health care or who may be restricted by language barriers. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
Not only does Charles Ogontade work as a mental health specialist in his day job, he spends his spare time as a volunteer offering support to the migrant community in Shepparton in northern Victoria.
What we find out is that a lot of these people, they actually struggled a lot.
The 47-year-old is a member of the Ethnic Council of Shepparton. He moved to Australia from Nigeria 15 years ago and usually meets with new migrants, asylum seekers and refugees face-to-face. But the council closed its doors when the pandemic began, and he's worried the people already struggling with their mental health are now even more isolated.
What we're left with is to call people on the phone. In my experience, in mental health itself, you get more information from what people are not telling you, from their body language, from their facial expression. And when you cannot do that, it becomes a real challenge.
The concern is if they're not seeing him or the other volunteers face to face, they may not seek help elsewhere. Most migrants on temporary or bridging visas don't have a Medicare card, while access to private services is both limited in regional areas and expensive. Charles Ogontade says many are also scared of walking into a clinic.
They're worried if they are struggling with their mental health, this will go into their record and it might jeopardize their chance of remaining in Australia permanently. Sometimes even when you try to convince them, say, look, this might not be the case, they will cite an example of a few cases that have happened.
So there's a reluctance to actually seek out mental health support.
Yes.
Because they're worried it might actually ruin their chances of getting a permanent visa.
Exactly.
There's also simply not as many specialist mental health services.
We know there's a great need because we've already started speaking to some of the GPs there. They've told us about how difficult it is to access specialist medical doctors.
Dr. Tram Nguyen is a consultant psychiatrist and the mental health director for not-for-profit organisation Cabrini Outreach, which runs asylum seeker support services in Melbourne. It's just secured Victorian government funding to expand its services into Shepparton and Mildura.
We have a project officer who is going to be on the ground speaking to ethnic council and communities, speaking to other healthcare providers there, including GPs and the local mental health services. The biggest piece of work is around building trust in services. We're also training some of the local community groups in how to use a screening tool that we've developed with regards to mental health for newly arrived people. And the third piece to it is that we are going to be taking referrals and so providing secondary opinions to GPs within the area as well. We can do that by the phone, through telehealth, through video link. So supporting the people who are already doing the work locally.
With the number of coronavirus cases in regional Victoria rising, there's an even greater need to ensure communities are able to cope.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting. Here's an interesting question for you to ponder. What does a pandemic smell like? Man's best friend, apparently, could be on the scent. Next month, Australian trials are set to test whether dogs can be used to sniff out COVID-19. Annie Guest reports.
With their 200 million or so scent receptors, dogs are detecting diabetic lows and imminent epileptic seizures, among other ills. These superior snouts are now being called into service as COVID sniffers. Veterinary researcher Dr. Susan Hazel is from the University of Adelaide.
The dogs could be a real game changer. Even picking up 10 asymptomatic people in a week's time, that can lead to 100 or more cases. So to flatten the curve and try and suppress, the dogs are going to be vital.
She's part of an international research project led by Professor Dominique Grangin from France's National Veterinary School. In April, he began training dogs, mostly German Shepherds and Labradors, to sniff out COVID-19, then sit.
In one day, the dogs were able to remember the odour of the positive COVID.
The odour comes from sweat scraped from people's armpits into containers that are then attached to stainless steel cones sniffed by the dogs. It's believed the smell is created by metabolic changes as the body responds to coronavirus. The French island of Corsica started officially using the COVID sniffing dogs last month.
In Corsica, been using them on different clusters due to the tourism in Corsica coming from the continent.
Okay, and tell me about the results you've had so far in Corsica. How many cases have they sniffed out?
They found 4 cases of real positives that had been negative on PCR. And this was out of something like 600 samples.
Trials are also underway in Chile and Belgium and...
Welcome to Dubai International Airport.
The dogs are already being used in the United Arab Emirates, where the Interior Ministry has released promotional videos of airport staff.
The UAE is a pioneer in this field.
Here in Australia, University of Adelaide veterinary researcher Dr. Annalise Chabert is negotiating with health authorities to collect sweat samples from people who've been tested for COVID-19.
So we are going to train dogs and follow exactly the same protocols as our colleague in France and in the United Arab Emirates.
She says they're in regular discussions with state and federal agencies to advance the project, but won't confirm whether emergency services, including the police, are involved. Co-researcher Dr. Susan Hazel says initial results will be reported to government in November.
If all goes according to plan, the dogs could be placed at borders, also in hospitals, also Indigenous communities.
That's Dr. Susan Hazel from Adelaide University, ending Annie Guest's report. If you're working from home at the moment, you might be having trouble sorting out somewhere safe and ergonomic to set up the laptop. You might be working from the kitchen table with electric cables and kids underfoot. There could be other accidents waiting to happen too. As working from home becomes the new norm, workplace health and safety lawyers are warning employers against leaving themselves liable. Isabel Rowe reports.
Sales executive Miriam's precarious home office setup will sound familiar to many of us.
In my two-bedroom unit, in the living space on my kitchen table at one end. So I have a monitor on one side, and then squish beside that on a puzzle box and a book, I have my laptop. The chair is really uncomfortable. And then once it's sort of, you get a numb bottom, you sort of move to a different space on the couch, you know, leaning over to a coffee table or just on your lap.
Do you find you get a sore back a lot?
Yeah, definitely.
Like most Australians, Miriam's transition to working from home was rushed.
You know, there was certainly no one that came and said, oh, how did you go setting up from home? You know, do you need anything? Is there anything we as a company can offer you? You know, do we need to get you a monitor or a laptop stand or anything like that?
That is the sort of thing that workplace lawyers say employers cannot afford to do.
There's no doubt that an employer is going to have to do more than simply provide a checklist.
Tom Bradley is a personal injury lawyer with Shine Lawyers. He says people working at home should expect their employer to actively check their meeting workplace health and safety guidelines.
People's homes, as we all know, are places where many accidents occur, so they're probably quite innately unsafe. An employer's duty probably would extend to doing more than simply providing someone with a list. They would need to provide them with active training and supervision in some cases.
There are two ways employees can be compensated if they're injured during a workday, through a workers' compensation claim or by suing their employer. But when the accident happens in a worker's own house, it's a bit more complicated. Tom Bradley explains.
For statutory benefits purposes, all that an employee needs to do is prove that their injury has arisen out of or in the course of their employment. So the question then becomes, well, what is, if you're working at home, what does that phrase actually mean? If you were, you know, injured in bed while working on your mobile phone for work purposes, and you get out of bed and you fall over, for example, you're probably likely to end up being in the scheme, because your employer has directed that you work from home, so you're at a place that you're required to be, and you're engaged in work activity when you're injured.
And for those getting through the day in slippers rather than regular work shoes, Colin Biggers and Paisley employment lawyer Greg McCann has a warning.
Because if you were in the office, you'd be wearing closed-in shoes, and because we're saying, well, you can work at home if you like, provided it's safe, then you should be meeting that same level of safety standards.
That's employment lawyer Greg McCann, and our reporter there, Isabel Rowe. One of Australia's biggest coal miners is under pressure from shareholders to effectively plan for its own demise. The shareholder resolution has been delivered to Whitehaven Coal just hours after news the mine received a green light from New South Wales authorities for a massive expansion of its Boggabri mine in the state's northwest. Here's National Environment reporter Michael Slezak.
Like many Australians, Marcus Fort juggles his day job and some of his other interests. He's a professor of smart cities at Queensland University of Technology and also an environmentalist and investor.
I've started quite early being interested in shares and the share market when I was probably 18 or 19.
One of the companies he's got shares in is Whitehaven Coal. It operates four mines in northwest New South Wales, exporting coal to Asia. Marcus Fort is one of more than 100 shareholders who have filed a resolution asking the company to wind up its coal operations, using the argument that investment in the resource will become worthless as the world shifts from fossil fuels.
That is with regards to advice from not just the Paris Agreement, but also with regards to the economic viability long term.
What Whitehaven Coal is facing is an example of how climate activism is moving from the streets to annual general meetings. If this resolution is legally sound, Whitehaven will have to put it to a vote at its upcoming AGM. A group called Market Forces, an affiliate of Friends of the Earth, is behind the campaign. Its organiser is Julian Vincent.
Whether you're concerned about climate change or not, surely every investor would be interested in a measure that would preserve their capital.
If Whitehaven gets out of coal, it would have to either transition to a different business or wind down the company and pay out what's remaining to shareholders. Martin Wilder is a lawyer, investment advisor, and an expert on climate law.
The law is clear that directors have a liability to take into account climate risks. I think if directors fail to do that, then you'll increasingly see resolutions from shareholders to remove those directors.
Whitehaven Coal is the first Australian mining company to face a shareholder resolution calling for it to be wound up. But other resource companies have been under pressure to disclose their climate risks or change their business strategies to meet the Paris climate targets. Whitehaven wants to use its just-approved Boggabri mine expansion to extract 168 million tonnes of coal over 30 years. The company declined to be interviewed, but in a statement said that it continues to see a role for coal as part of the global energy transition, arguing that high-quality coal can contribute to meaningful carbon emission reductions.
Michael Slezak reporting there. And that is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Chris Dangate, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Climate activists have been going after coal mines for years. Now they're trialling a new tactic. After buying into a major mining company, some Australian activists are now using their shareholders' rights to petition the company's board to close it down.
Today on The Signal, we hear about the latest trend in climate activism. What do the activists think they'll achieve? And is it just a stunt? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.